March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, where it's 10:59 a.m. on the fifth Friday of March, 2019, which means we'll be hearing from Mr. Jones's neighborhood in just a moment. One of our friends and neighbors that makes it possible for us to bring you such programs, I'm going to tell you about right now. KBOO programming may be made possible by KBOO listener members and support from Portland Underground Graduate School, a local independent learning community offering courses and workshops for continuing lifelong learning. Scholarships and other tuition opportunities available. Course options and more information online at pugspdx.com.
It's a beautiful day.
Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the Children's Program for Reluctant Adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. Our guests today are David Shields, author of the new book, The Trouble with Men, Reflections on Sex, Love, Marriage, Porn, and Power, in conversation with Portland writer Sally Tisdale. Sally's most recent book is Advice for Future Corpses, A Practical Perspective on Death and Dying. We'll also be talking to old friend of the show, David Koff of Fake Radio. They'll be performing a live, on-stage radio theater production of the classic Bogart Bergman film Casablanca tomorrow at the Old Church in downtown Portland. So it's sex, death, and radio theater on today's show, which is pretty much all we think about here on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, and pretty much in that exact order. First up, we have David and Sally live with us now in the KBOO studios. David Shields and Sally Tisdale, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Ken. Very nice to be here.
David, let's start with you. The book's described on the back cover as, among other things, a love letter to your wife, and the first of the book's five sections is titled, Let's Say I'm Writing a Love Letter to You, but the book's not your typical love letter. It's often unflattering to both you and your wife. Seems more of an inquiry into the relationship, covering both your desire, your doubts, your fears. Why call it a love letter?
Those are all very good questions. Someone said to me something like, it's probably the strangest love letter ever written and or the strangest marriage manual ever written. I mean, not to be too flattering to our fellow visitor here today, but there's a line of Sally's I've always loved. I can't tell you, or I can tell you, how important this thing was. Sally and I were taking a walk around Green Lake Park in Seattle a few years ago. I was trying to figure out how to write the book, and Sally said, sort of speaking to herself but also speaking to me, what are you afraid of writing about? That's your real subject. Which I think is something she says to herself and what she says to her students, and I think in a way it's maybe sort of standard writing advice, but I feel like, you know, yes, if I wanted to write a love letter, like, you know, there's huge parts of me which just have a very ordinary marriage, which, you know, I'm relatively happily married, and, you know, we just have a functional and good relationship.
But How long have you been married?
I was married in 1990, so I've been married almost 30 years. You know, and I have, you know, I don't know, I don't have any particular label on it, but at some point in my life, I just, you know, I don't know if every 30-year-old marriage has that, but where you just, you know, that wonderful line of Woody Allen's, you know, a relationship must move forward or it dies, you know, what we have here is a dead shark. I've sort of mangled the line, but secondly, a shark has to keep on moving forward or it dies. What we have here in this relationship is a dead shark. Anyway, the relationship seemed to me a little stultified, a little moribund, as maybe a lot of 30-year-old marriages are. It seemed to have an underlying, subtle, somewhat unspoken, somewhat oblique, slightly sadomasochistic dynamic, which I needed to unpack as a person, as a husband, as a sexual being, just for my own sanity and my own psychic health and my own literary excitement. Like, what is this thing between us? Was actually a line in the book. Like, who are we toward each other? And so, you know, I didn't think I'd ever finish the book. I didn't think I'd ever publish it. I didn't think I would still be married after I wrote the book. And all those things are true. I wrote the book. I'm proud of the book. I think it's among the better books I've written.
And you're still married.
And I'm still married.
And I know David's wife. And I remember at some point, some years ago, when you were writing about sex, you told me she really didn't want you to do this.
Yeah.
And we had that conversation that writers have about, do I move forward and what's my risk-benefit analysis here? But it looks like she got beyond that.
Sort of. I mean, in a sense that I just published an essay in millions.com about the post-publication of the book in which I sort of said, okay, I've written this book, and what is my wife's take on it? The irony of the book is because she is a relatively kind of macho lady who's very John Wayne, and I'm very much, you know, in a way, I'm very much the femme in the relationship who loves to just talk about everything. And she's this sort of typically masculine presence who's sort of silent and stoic.
You call yourself the babbler, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. She's a classic Dead Sea, by which means she doesn't have to talk. And I'm, as you can tell, I'm a kind of a babbler, which may be a revenge on my childhood stutter. Now I can actually talk halfway decently, and I just love to talk. But that she's not someone who likes to unpack emotionally what's going on. It's all in gestures or in good deeds or whatever. So anyway, because she's not an emotionally
open or
expressive human being, I needed to write this letter to her to try to unpack what's going on. The irony being, I wrote the book, I thought, to reanimate our marriage. Either it would save the marriage and reanimate it, or possibly bring it to a relatively civil end. The irony being that she said, if you want to publish the book, you can. I don't particularly like it. I think it's more about you, David, than it is about me. But if you want to publish it, that's okay with me. And I don't want to talk about the book, and I don't want to hear about the book.
Did she even read the final manuscript
before? She read the book twice. Uh-huh. And to my surprise, she was like, okay. Her response seems to me very paradoxical, and perhaps Sally can explain it. Because, like, to me, it's like I thought she'd either love the book, like, this is such, it's such to me a vulnerable and human and expressive book, in which to me it is a love letter of sorts. I thought sure she'd either love it or hate the book, but instead it was like, okay, let's move on. It's like, what? And so
I get that. No,
do you get
I
that?
Get that.
Explain
because,
that to me, Sally.
You know, I'm fascinated by the issue of presentation and appearance and what we present to the world and how people see us and how it's impossible for us ever to experience another person seeing us. We can never see ourselves in anything like the way other people see us. I can see that your wife is disconnected from this book. It's your drama. It's your stuff. And you know, and it's your view. You also, I gotta say, you've carved out this idea that there are some blurry lines between fiction and nonfiction. She has a total back door of, oh, that paragraph? He made that up. Any place in the book that she's not comfortable with, she can just tell anybody he made that up. And only you and she will ever know what's real here.
That's a good point.
So, but I think she also, you know, this is about you. This book is about you.
I agree.
It's really not about her. And she knows that she's not truly the subject. Your own psyche is the subject.
And
I have a question for you, David.
Okay, Sal.
I'm going to read this quote.
Okay.
What is the matter with me? Do I just have a bigger self-destruct button and like to push it harder and more incessantly than everyone else? So my question is, what is the matter with you?
Oh my God! Talk about the pot calling the kettle black, Sal. Holy
now,
Moses!
Now.
But
now
you did this book help you figure out what is the matter with you? We all want to know what the matter with ourselves is.
Exactly.
So what is
that's
what
the question? I mean, first of all, I thought what you said earlier was really spot on. That everyone else, I have this wonderful quote from Hilton Owls, you know. What else do we have in the world but phantoms that we dream everyone else into existence? I think of Sally as a friend I've known for 25 years, but do I truly know her? Not really. I sort of imagine Sally into existence as she imagines me. Like, we know each other as friends, but we are hugely projecting our own fears and fantasies onto people, especially in a sexual context. But in terms of what is the matter with me, it's this line which I wish I'd gotten into the book. What's matter with me is not the, I mean, it's the matter with me, but it's the matter with everyone. Wonderful line by the Romanian French aphorist E.M. Chiron, who says, "Only one thing matters: learning to be the loser," which is very anti-American, you know, because we're, you know, capital of capitalism, we're supposed to always succeed, and for a variety of reasons, whether, you know, childhood stutter, a mother who was rather draconian and authoritarian, but like, I'm drawn toward loss, you know, I'm drawn toward what's the matter with me. I think we all have drives toward eros and thanatos, you know, toward sex and death.
And death,
you know, and I'm just really alert to that part of us that's broken, that's wounded, that's lost, that's morbid, that's sad, that's gloomy, that's melancholy, that's death infested. You know, I think some people are full of life force, and I have parts of me that are hugely full of life force, that part of me that's creative. But there's a huge part of me, I mean, I wrote a book a while ago called The Thing About Life Is That One Day You'll Be Dead, which is a sort of, you know, almost like a masochistic title to dwell on death. So I think the thing that I really confronted in the book, which I never had confronted directly in any of my previous 21 books, is that I'm not, you know, a whips and chains guy who wants to be, you know, hugely masochistic in some like super dungeony way, but I have a subtle but persistent self-punishing streak. And it's there in me. And the great challenge and excitement of the book was to really explore it and come out the other end like, that's okay. You know, amor fati, as Nietzsche says, love your own fate. And I feel like the excitement of the book to me is like, at the end of it, like, yeah, so what? I'm slightly on the masochistic scale. So are many humans.
Do you get unhappy or suspicious when things are going too well? I just mentioned there's one line in the book where you are a Mariner fan. You live in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
And you have a line in there where you'll check the score on your phone, and sometimes you just need them to lose, which
right.
is odd for a fan to say.
Somebody quoted that in a review, and she said, you know, Shields is masochistic to his very marrow. He needs the Mariners to lose, which that just strikes me as realistic. You know, sounds like they won last night, but
they're undefeated.
I know.
One of my questions for you is, Ichiro retired this week. Did you know that?
I've been inconsolable.
Okay, so I knew you would know that one of your books was...
My Amazon number skyrocketed, yeah. Sally.
Because he has a book of quotes from Ichiro, his sort of mangled English, which he now speaks fluently but doesn't like to use. But yes, this is a watershed moment for you,
I know.
David.
Well, Ichiro, I did an interview with him, you know, 15 years ago, and I wrote an essay about him, and I wrote a book.
What was the book called?
Called Baseball is Just Baseball, The Understated Ichiro.
Ah.
And I think it's a cool little collage book, and it came out in 2001. What you say is really interesting to me about, Ken, about this idea of Are you suspicious when things are going too well? Because it connects a little bit. I mean, we're here to talk about Trouble with Men and Sally's book, Advice for Future Corpses, but it relates a little bit to a book I published in October called Nobody Hates Trump More Than Trump, An Intervention, in which I try to explore the sort of psychology of Trump and the way it relates to the Trumpian base. And I think one of my many readings of Trump is that he's a hugely self-loathing and self-defeating human being. Why else would he, after the brief reprieve of the Barr memo, sort of vis-a-vis the Mueller report, why would Trump step on his own success and quickly go to
destroying healthcare?
To destroying healthcare. Right. It seemed insane.
But don't you think it connects to the fact that his base is the most self-hating and self-defeating group of people in the country? They work against their own self-interest continuously.
Exactly.
And there seems to be this kind of willful refusal to admit that he is hurting them.
That's
right in your face, you know. You're losing your health care, you're losing your Medicaid, you're losing your jobs.
But I will say, lock her up or whatever.
Right.
There seems to
be this very strange masochism in Trump's base.
It's a really good point. And I think it's the key, a huge key to his success is, you know, it relates to sexuality in the sense that, you know, in psychoanalysis, there's something called lack and there's something called excess. And lack is some kind of gap that we feel in ourselves, the fact that we're going to die or that we're ugly or that we're unhappy or something, and that we tend to take a revenge on that lack through excess, you know, eating too much sugar or being alcoholic or a sex addict or being a, you know, in my view, a Trump fan, because, you know, a lot of these people, a huge amount of Trump's base, other than the 1% of the 1%, are people who have, you know, overt lacks in their life, could be health insurance, could be crummy job or whatever, and that Trump's excess is hugely appealing as reparation theater, as revenge on the overt emptiness of their life. And to bring it back a bit, that's the way sexual fantasy works. The reason why sexual fantasy is so powerful as opposed to, say, sort of vanilla sex in which one is just having sex for procreative purposes or sort of
conventional
pleasure, like, you know, yes, I'm going to have an orgasm. But the way sexual fantasy works and why it's so important what people's sexual fantasies are and to understand them is that they tend to be a really powerful expression of your deepest unconscious needs. And I don't know if you'd want to push back against that, Sally, or if that, I feel like that is congruent.
I have a quote from Sally in the book that you might want to...
Do I quote Sally? I quote her all in the book.
Yeah, there's quite a few, but here's one that relates to what you just said, David. All of us are wounded, and the deepest wound always comes back to sex.
Well, and I would say that in that sense, everything comes back to sex, because I do believe there is this life force in us of Eros, and that to the extent that we allow that to move through us, there's an ability to be, I know you're not going to like this word, but wholesome in your sexuality. Whatever your kink is, whatever your expression of it is, wholesome sexuality is owning it, showing up for it, and not keeping it hidden and somehow neurotic. So, you know, you can have an extremely unusual sexual expression and do it in a very wholesome way. And you can have...
Wholesome in what sense, Sally? Like in the sense that not repressing it.
Yeah, not distorted or deformed or self-hating. I know people who engage in unconventional sexual expression of all kinds, but they're very grounded, stable, pretty self-liking people, pretty healthy people with a, you know, a good, strong, stable life. And I know people who are just distorted in their life, and it expresses itself in their, no matter how vanilla or conventional their sexual behavior is, it's really kinky. It's distorted and hateful. So when I think that brokenness, we have to own, like David said, you really have to admit that there's a wound in the center, that's where all of this comes from. I'd love to explore, I'd love to know what Trump's sexual life is like.
Oh, and, my God, tell me about it.
And I know a lot of people have spent some time thinking about it, but
well, there's that crucial gesture where he has I mean, I didn't mean to interrupt, Sally, but, you know, there's that amazing moment where Stormy Daniels, you know, has a copy of Forbes magazine where Trump is on the cover. And it's basically, you know, Trump's, you know, wants, I mean, again, one can't extrapolate hugely from that. But I'm not sure I'd be up for, like, even playfully someone spanking me. Like, it's just not my particular kink. Like, I'm just not a big spanky. It's called the British sin.
You want to have your psyche spanked. Ooh. Maybe not your bottom.
That's so startling, Sally. But anyway, what's my point? My point is, like, that's a tiny insight into Trump, and is not that he wanted to be spanked. And to me, there was an incredible moment with Howard Stern, which is in the Trump book. And I don't know if we can say that. I think we can say this: that Trump tells Howard Stern that he's not a fan of fellatio, you know, which is a technical term.
Technical term, yes.
And so that, clinical. Like, to me, it's like, really?
Really?
Like,
why?
How could someone, like,
very few people
like,
say
how
that.
Could not, like, Howard Stern says, I've asked a bunch of men, do you really care about oral sex? And I assume he means being the recipient of it. Trump says, no, it's not important to me. It's like, really? Like, and part of this book does explore how much oral sex is really vital to me as someone who stuttered as a kid quite badly. Like, the mouth is this big thing to me. Like, the mouth and sexuality is like the center of my sexuality. Anyway, it's probably too much information for your KBOO listeners.
But
no,
it is,
we could talk a little
book,
bit about more of that. You have one. You're talking about your masochistic desires, which don't go as far as getting spanked, or
I mean,
of course, there was that Steele, that Steele dossier where something happened in a hotel room Moscow. So
yes.
That seems even more masochistic. But you cite Lauren Emmy Goodlad.
Real name. That's a former colleague of mine. Yeah.
Straight men interested in erotic submission far exceed the number of women willing to dominate them. Men's interest in taking a passive, submissive, or masochistic sexual role remains one of the most taboo subjects in our culture, and yet it seems to be maybe the majority of men who have that inclination.
I'm not sure if it's the majority, but it's pretty common. Because, you know, so many men, I mean, so much porn, so many fantasies are about, you know, the sexy dominatrix nurse, the sexy authoritarian teacher, you know, the whole teacher, you know, kitten with a whip. That whole thing is like a massive part of male sexuality, because frankly, men still, in Western culture, still have most of the power. And so the idea of you be the powerful person, a sexual fantasy, like, hey man, if you're running the corporation, like, you're already sort of living the fantasy. And so most sexuality inverts one's overt conscious life, but that line of Lauren Goodlad is crucial. And I mean, I think that one of the contributions of the book, I mean, I'm not here to debate if it's a good or bad book, I'm proud of it, but I think if there is a contribution the book makes, and Sally can and should correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not aware of any book, frankly, ever written by a straight white male writer that is a work of nonfiction that overtly explores the writer's masochism. A lot of gay writers have explored that. Some amazing women writers have explored that. Some trans writers have explored that. But, like, the male default position in this culture, alas, is an alpha position. And, like, to me, what is so taboo about the book, and which I find so challenging and so nervous-making about writing it, was like, oh my God, as a man, as a teacher, as a professor, as a father, as a husband, like, you're always supposed to be alpha, at least somewhat, pretend you're alpha, a la Trump. But to me, to, like, say, hey, I'm sort of on the sub side, it's like, really? You are really not supposed to say that. And that was what made it such an exciting project. I don't know if you want to push back against some of that, Sally.
Well, I was going to give one cultural touch point, which you mentioned in the book, and which I identified with quite a bit, because we're about the same generation.
I'm 62. Are you?
I'm 65, actually.
Look at you. You're in great shape, Ken.
Oh, thanks. Viewers at home, do you hear that?
I know. Ken is bringing it.
So we were both fans of the TV show Get Smart.
Oh, yeah.
And you mentioned there, you've got
Feldon.
Yes, you've got this kind of switch in the power relationship with Barbara Feldon, this very tall wasp, strong woman, and then you've got kind of the short Schlemiel, the Jewish guy, Maxwell Smart.
Oh, there's tons of that stuff. The 50-foot woman and she, and I mean, there's...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, even Captain
even
Marvel now, Ms.
Genie.
Marvel.
I mean, the women,
I know.
The women were dominant in a lot of ways.
It's Kitty with a whip, for sure. And the bar. I do a long riff on that show. I mean, Barbara Feldon was it. I mean, she was... I've gotten so many... A book has only been published a month ago. I got so many emails from friends or acquaintances, like, oh my God, yes, Barbara Feldon.
I identified with that. I didn't identify with a part that seemed to be picked out by the New York Times Review, where they said they were almost embarrassed to read your obsession with Pippa Middleton.
Well, that was just from... It was a very laudatory review from Pearl Segal, who also...
And isn't that entirely about Pippa's backside? I think it's not just David. There's a lot of Pippa.
There
was a word that I looked up, and now I know. Was it Caligian?
Yes.
Calipigian.
Calipigian.
Which means kind of like a shapely...
Which means a very beautiful bottom.
But specifically kind of...
A large,
beautiful, sort of shapely derriere. But, you know, there's a whole huge thing about when Pippa Middleton got married, she wore this dress that hugely outlined her buttocks, you know. And so I was just doing a riff. I mean, I think it was a funny line by the reviewer, Pearl Segal, who also reviewed Sally's book, quite positively, so she has obviously incredibly good taste. But, you know, she was just saying, I thought she was doing a little bit of pushback against English Empire, like how dare somebody like Pippa Middleton, because she is the English royalty, you know, because
she's an aristocrat.
You know, she's an aristocrat, and it's like, I don't want to hear about how you're grooving on Pippa Middleton's derriere, and she was just kidding.
It was a strange remark.
It was a funny tweet.
and it's such a small part of the book. It's one line.
she was just the best thing she said about it. She goes, this book is ridiculous and brave, and someone said you should put that on your epitaph, because, you know, that's the essence of writing to me, is being ridiculous and brave, saying outrageous things and being brave about exploring them.
Okay, so I'm going to let me push back a little bit about what you said. So it's vulnerable, it's exposing, you're very transparent in here. When I published Talk Dirty to Me, I had many people say to me, oh, you're so brave, how could you put all that out there? And my response was, you don't know what I didn't put in this book.
Which I actually quote in the book.
You know,
you saying that,
so,
Sally?
I don't remember, but...
I do.
But what, you know, surely there is material that is not in this book. We, if we're good at our job, there's an artless sense to it. And it seems, it appears to the reader
to be naked,
that we're telling everything.
Right.
But of course we're not. The writer's job is partly about casting light and shadow in such a way that it looks a certain way, just like a painter. But we hold back what we're not able to process yet. And maybe there's another book 5 or 10 years down the road that explores this in another way. But
I hope not.
How much, compared to what is in the book, how big is that deep abyss of unspoken material?
Vis-a-vis sexuality?
Sexuality, psyche, your inner life, you...
I mean...
The unspoken
what
you.
David left out of the book?
Yeah. How big is what's left out?
I mean, I think that's a great... I mean, I do love that thing that you said, which I think I do quote in the book, which I remember admiring Talk Dirty to Me a lot, both the essay and the book, and that I remember being quite struck. I think I told you that, or I forgot in what context, where I said, you know, I really admire the book, and you said, or perhaps you wrote somewhere, like, everyone says how brave I was, they have no idea stuff I left out. And that was really, to me, marching orders in terms of my book. Like, if Sally felt somewhat that she avoided certain things in that book, I wanted to see if I could be as honest as I could. I mean, I think in earlier drafts, there was maybe a slightly more sexually explicit stuff that I pulled away that may be a little... I'm trying to think of what... I mean, there's nothing...
What was the reason for that? For pulling? Did you felt it was too personal?
I showed it to some friends or to a couple friends and they just said, like, enough is enough, or like, it's all implied here.
And the question always has to be, does it work? You know, is it serving your purpose as a writer? If it makes the reader so uncomfortable they don't keep reading, then it doesn't work.
I think there was an early draft of the end of the book that seemed to me, or seemed to at least one smart reader of an early draft, who said something like, it just pushed a self-loathing into too dark a place that you just couldn't come out of it. And he just said, like, just imply it. And I think, you know, I think the book has, in a way, for all of its collage feel, it really has a conventional narrative arc. It introduces a subject, it flips that subject backwards, it reintroduces a subject from a new perspective, it takes you into an incredibly dark space via porn. And to me, it kind of comes out the end with saying, like, hey, that we're all broken, and the only way that we can heal is through scar tissue. So, I mean, I think of the book as weirdly upbeat in a strange way.
It does. I do not think it leaves you with the sense that you are so wounded, you're crawling. You seem, especially because of your ability to do pretty deep and detailed self-analysis, that's strength.
Thanks, Sally. That's hugely meaningful to me coming from you. Thank you.
And a kind of wholeness. So at the end, you know, I think you do leave the reader with the sense that you're upright and walking. You're not lying on the floor.
Thank you. And I mean, part of it is humor, don't you think? Like, the book's not hilarious, but the book is a little bit wry, a little bit...
Oh, I thought there were a few really funny lines.
Yeah.
There was one in particular where, because my wife is very similar to this.
In what sense?
I joke a lot, and she doesn't always get it or enjoy it.
Yeah, that's a little bit like Lori. I'm married to Margaret Dumont.
Yes, I was a big Marx Brothers fan. I knew exactly what you were saying.
I love Margaret Dumont. Too. She's just like the great. She's a great image.
That line cracked you up.
I'm a big Groucho fan.
And so I say something like, the awful comedy of this, I'm married to someone who doesn't get my jokes. I'm married to Margaret Dumont, or something like that. And, you know, there's a little bit of a sense. Some of it is sort of Jew-wash stuff. That, you know, if I'm with, say, a Jewish woman talking to her, like, that we have this immediate connection. Because we all have the same shared humor, and it's sort of like there's no eros there, because, I mean, there might be for some Jewish men and Jewish women, but for some reason, the way I'm built, like, when I connect immediately with someone, like, oh, we have all this same shared history, it's like there's no other there.
I identified with that, too. I'm Jewish, and my wife's not. She was.
But
she grew up Lutheran.
Is Ken Jones, though?
It was changed on Ellis Island.
Oh, brother.
It was, initially, Yanofsky.
Well, look at that.
Well, you mentioned your original name there. It's not
is
Shields.
Schildkraut. I know.
Yeah.
I wish I had changed it to D. Jonathan Schildkraut. Oh, that's a mouthful.
But you do say in there about the lack of sexual desire usually between the Jewish male and the Jewish female.
Do you agree? I mean, have you experienced that?
It's true in my case, but I don't think we should generalize too much.
No, totally not. And, you know, I mean, yeah, it's ridiculous. But there's a there's a part of the book I really like is this stuff about the way different cultures' sexual fantasies tend to be expressive of that culture's traumatic history. Like, there's this amazing thing. I think it comes from Susie Bright, the wonderful writer on sex. I think that you've done some panels
with
her, haven't
Susie.
You, Sally?
Yeah.
She's great. And she talks about this amazing and really sad and scary stuff that a lot of Israeli porn uploads the Holocaust as part of its shadow theater. It'll have trains and nurses in strange garb and doctors wearing kind of night porter clothes. It's like, really? Yes, of course. That when we lack an excess again, when we go to sexual fantasy, we're going to upload trauma. And that's the most moving and powerful thing I've ever heard. That Israeli
porn. It's true around the world. There,
Japanese porn.
A cross-cultural anthropological study of pornography is the history of the world.
That's our next book, Sally. We're going to write that one.
Oh, I don't know if I could tolerate
travel
the
around
research.
The world.
I remember, you know, just being really struck by how different Japanese pornography was from American pornography. And it actually just sensibly comes out of their social dynamics and their daily culture and who has power and who rules which part of the culture. It's just, and we look at America, the great American pornography image of virility and strength and stamina and keep going and excess in every way, you know, this hungry culture we have where we're all supposed to be ambitious and strong and productive.
Voracious,
and,
yeah.
And you know, bring it on. And our pornography is just filled with this weird kind of constant excess.
Do you know the book? There's a book called The Erotic Mind by an author named Jack Morin, M-O-R-I-N.
And read a long time ago.
He explains a lot of that kind of pornography and lust and desire for things like you had mentioned, maybe images of the Holocaust for Jewish pornography, as a way for somebody to control something in fantasy in their mind that they have absolutely no control over in real life. So it's a healing thing in a lot of respects.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I completely echo what David said, that understanding sexual fantasy is very important. It's a journey every person should do for themselves, really admit to and examine what these unconscious, sort of spontaneously appearing sexual fantasies are. Everybody has them. They show, and many people push them aside or push them down and don't want to claim them. You don't have to act on them. You don't have to tell anybody. But I think it's, you know, I think we all could benefit from looking at this material. Where does it come from? You know, and I don't necessarily want to make any of it come true. I think that's a mistake people make, is that somehow fantasy is something we want to bring into the world. Absolutely not. Fantasy is a window into your unspoken self, into the inarticulated self that others don't see. It's that, you know, please see me. I want to be seen. I want to be clearly seen. No, don't. Please don't look at me. I don't want to be seen. That tension that we all have is right there.
That's beautiful. I mean, it's so much the dirty little secret of this book is that in a way I'm more interested in thinking about sex and articulating sex and poeticizing sex and fantasizing about, like, sex itself is, you know, I like sex as much as the next person, but the book, you know, at 62 years old, am I sexually obsessed? Not really, but I'm obsessed with thinking and trying to understand sex. That I'm excited by, you know, sex, you know, yeah, I enjoy sex, but it's sort of like no more than anyone else, but it's sort of like the book's sort of melancholy secret is that I'm at least as interested in writing and reading and thinking about sex as I am in sex per se, which is maybe the thing that my wife understands. Like, okay, David, if you want to go off and think about it, fine, but that doesn't have that much to do with me, as Sally nicely pointed out, I think.
Yeah, that was another passage I identified with, David, again, because we're pretty much the same generation. Uh-huh. You write, at 61, of course, now you're 62,
right.
I have a different view of sex than I had at 41 or 51 or even 55. I'm obsessed with it, as I think I am, and maybe a lot of men our age. But a lot of what I want to do is think about it. I'm about the same age as you and feel pretty much the same way. So I just love that passage.
Thank you.
And of course, you both are very brave and courageous writers, and you hear that over and over again. So
well, thank you,
I hope that's not too trite.
No, that's
real. I just want to speak up here for the postmenopausal woman, which is, you know, some women don't feel a difference in their libido with menopause, but many of the women I know have felt a distinct lightening of their libido, a reduction in their libido with menopause, and it's wonderful. Let me tell you, it's a great relief.
I've heard men say that, older men.
There's a famous Sophocles line, like, finally, I'm relieved from this horrible monster.
Right.
I can finally live my life, he said, at age 70. Like,
I can think for 5 minutes without being distracted.
Right.
And I had really strong sexual desire in my 20s, and I think back to that now, and it just seems like another person altogether, the way it would preoccupy me, and it was a big part of my marriage, and what a relief to have that energy. Maybe it's that generalized Eros life energy. I've been writing a lot more.
I know, you've been so prolific of late. My God, Sally.
It is. It's it. I.
It's a way of channeling that energy into something maybe a little more constructive than thinking about sex all the time.
Yeah, now I'm much more interested in Thanatos.
Alas,
but
yeah.
We should probably get to a little book.
I know. We got to talk about advice.
Yeah, I had that transition here.
Sally handed you the transition.
Right.
We talked about baseball, sex, and death. We haven't talked about
Casablanca's
that.
Casablanca's coming up, right?
Casablanca tomorrow, but we'll be talking with David Koff.
I gotcha.
And I wanted to transition into death by something you also wrote in the book. You took creative writing when you were a grad student from John Hawkes.
He was an undergraduate teacher.
Oh, undergraduate. But he's a somewhat underappreciated but great novelist, I think.
I totally agree.
And he said, you write that Hawkes would often solemnly inform you that you were obsessed with sex and death.
Or that Hawkes was obsessed. It's supposed to be Hawkes who's in.
Oh, he was. I didn't realize but that. I thought it was you.
I may have misframed it.
Uh-huh.
He's meant to say, Hawkes would intone. I know, I was trying to explain it in the book, and I think it sounds like that I didn't explain it quite right. But he would say he was obsessed with sex and death, and I would say, well, what is there to say about sex and death except sex is good and death is bad? And now, 40 years later, I realize how intertwined Eros and Thanatos is sort of the arc of the entire book.
Yeah, so before you go, I just wanted to talk a little bit about it. I looked up last year when your book came out, Sally. David actually was in conversation with you at Elliott Bay Books in Seattle. What went on there?
We got in a huge argument. I don't know if we even want to talk about it.
Oh, yeah, we threw things at each other. No, David was furious. He was very selfless and gracious. It was a lovely interview. He's very good about that kind of thing. And that was when the book first came out. And, you know, what I found is that people have the same questions at readings and signings with this book as they do when I've talked workshops about getting ready for death. You know, we have very common concerns about death, fear of physical pain, fear of loss of dignity and modesty and privacy, but underneath it all there's just this unspoken existential, what happens next?
Yes.
What does it mean for
with
the
no
self
answers.
With this for the self to dissolve? And I was just asked yesterday in an interview, you say that death can be joyous, which is not exactly what I say. But what can happen is it may be the most likely moment in our entire human life that our heart is truly open. Maybe right after birth, our heart is truly open to love. But as we become adults, we become defended, we become protected, we become neurotic and confused and self-absorbed. And as death approaches, a lot of that does seem to fall away for some people, not just the dying person, but the person closest to the dying person. Suddenly you're able to cherish a person in a way that I have never been able to cherish during sex or in a marriage or anything else, because there's always an investment that you're protecting. At that last moment, there's nothing left to protect. Is it joy? I don't know, but it is a kind of openness that maybe is what we're looking for in orgasm all the time. That
and
surrender.
Of course, the French word for that is le petit mort.
The little death.
It brings it all full circle. Yeah.
It's very true that little death is when you drop the defended and protected self. And for one moment, you just let your heart open. That in next instant, you shut it. Mm-hmm. In sex, but at death you don't get to. So I do think of it as kind of this next big adventure we're going to have.
All of us have that to look forward to.
Well,
we should wrap up. David Shields and Sally Tisdale, again, thank you very much
thank
for joining
so
us
much,
on KABU this morning.
It was so fun to chat with you and with you, Sally, too, obviously.
Yeah. All right. Love being on KABU. Thank you for doing what you do.
We'll be back for more Mr. Jones's Neighborhood after this musical break.
Well, did that go at all? Baby, take off your coat. Feel slow. take to shoot. Baby, take off your dress. Can't leave your hat on. Go all over there, turn on the light. Know all the lights. Come back here, stand on this chair. That's right.
Hey, welcome back to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation. Our next guest is a good friend of KABU and an important figure in Portland's radio theater community, David Koff, Artistic Director of Fake Radio. Fake Radio will be performing a live on-stage radio theater production, really a big treat, of the classic Bogart Bergman film Casablanca tomorrow at the Old Church in downtown Portland. David, welcome back to the neighborhood.
Thank you. It's such a beautiful neighborhood.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
It really is, yeah. It is gorgeous Portland day.
Right. Now, David, you've been on the show before, but for listeners who may not know, can you tell us first a little bit about Fake Radio, the history? It was started by Robin Jones, and you took it over from him in Los Angeles?
I did, yeah. Our first show with me as artistic director was back in 2005, but Robin had created this idea of unearthing old broadcast radio scripts, performing them live, including the original commercials that aired, but kind of turning into a bit of a variety show. But there was no real rehearsal process, so the actors, who were stand-up comedians, improvisers, traditional voice actors, including some recognizable names in the worlds of comedy and acting and TV and film, they would go off script occasionally, to the great delight of the 15 to 20 people we used to perform for back in the day.
But it was the first time they had seen the script, actually sitting down at the performance?
Yeah.
Or standing up in front of a mic?
Exactly. And so, you know, they would kind of play around with the script, and actors would make a mistake, and there would be a moment on stage where the other actors would kind of pounce on the one who had made a mistake, and there'd be a funny improvised moment. And it added this level of approachability and modernness and fun, so much fun, to a style of art that most people think maybe is outdated or a part of history where it should remain, and we feel completely
Yeah, that golden age of radio.
Yeah.
But that was the primary medium in America in the 1930s,
exactly.
1940s, before television.
But how do you take something like that, that is in many ways, with its, especially its language towards women and minorities and marginalized groups, how do you take material like that, but make it more palatable for modern day ears. Well, it turns out playing with the script and kind of doing a loving parody and keeping it tongue in cheek is the best way of doing it. So our audiences love coming to watch us pick apart some of these, you know,
right,
these moments in the script. Yeah.
And your first Portland production was Christmas time, December 2017. You did It's a Wonderful Life.
We did. We had a couple shows at the Alberta Rose Theater and a show out at the Vault Theater in Hillsboro, which is a just wonderful local regional
That's where I saw
here.
It. And your guest star, Kevin McDonald.
Our guest star was Kevin McDonald from the Kids in the Hall. And we've been very fortunate over the years. We've been doing the show to have some truly amazing...
Oh, my idol, Philip Proctor.
We
have
Phil
in your
Proctor.
Last production.
We've had three of the Kids in the Hall, Mark McKinney, Kevin McDonald, David Foley. We've had some of the great stand-up comedians and voice artists. Tom Kenny, who's the voice of SpongeBob SquarePants. Maria Bamford, who's a very popular...
Oh, extremely funny comedian. Yes.
Three different Emmy Award-winning actors. John Larroquette, Ray Romano, Marshall Wallace. I am lucky. And in this case, we have Mindy Sterling.
Oh, yeah.
Who
can
is
you tell
us
a little bit about her? She was Frau Verbissina in the Austin Powers movies.
She played Dr. Evil's wife and evil henchwoman in all three of the Austin Powers movies. And she's a classically trained improviser. She was trained at the Groundlings in Los Angeles.
And you are too, right?
I also trained at the Groundlings.
And you teach.
I do teach. The difference between Mindy and I is I never joined the main company. And she did. She was one of the members of the Groundlings from way back. She's unbelievably talented and now has had 3+ decades of not only acting on stage and screen, but also in doing voice work for a lot of roles that are animated. So I can't think of anyone better to come to town to help us recreate this American classic.
How do you get people like Mindy and Phil Proctor and Kevin McDonald and the other stars you mentioned?
Early on, you know, I would just meet people because I was a member of the cast. Later, when I became the artistic director and had to produce the show, I did the same thing anyone would do. I just started knocking on doors. And I explained to people, here's what we're doing. It's a very, very light commitment. It's a ton of fun. There's no memorization. If you're an actor, to be able to get on stage and have a blast and not have to memorize anything, that's a real treat. It's a 3-hour commitment and then you're done. It's harder now because I got to fly people up to Portland, but it's all right.
And who fills out the rest of the cast? Is Sam in there? Or Sam Mowry?
Sam Mowry has been in the cast for a couple of years. He's unable to perform right now due to health reasons. Mm-hmm. He's mostly staying behind the mic as opposed to getting on stage.
And he was in War of the Worlds, the production last October.
He played our Orson Welles, Professor Pearson.
Sounds just like him.
There's nobody in Portland who more embodies the voice and spirit of Orson Welles than Sam Mowry. But here in town, my cast is made up of some incredible actors and improvisers. So, Keri
did you
Leek,
want to name a few?
Absolutely. Keri Leek, Betsy Green, Beau Brousseau, Talon Bigelow. We're adding a few new people to this particular show. Linda Brown, Janet Scanlon, Nathan Duncan. I'm really blessed in that I have been able to meet some really talented people here in town. And as always, Fake Grody is a really great combination of actors, voice artists, improvisers, and stand-up, and there's this unbelievable synergy that happens when all of those people get on stage and get the opportunity
to play. I've seen all the productions in Portland.
I know.
I agree with
you. You can probably speak to what it's like to be in the audience better than most. You're an ongoing fan of the show, for
a
which
big
we're
fan,
very
yes.
grateful.
And what's the next production, of course, tomorrow is at the Old Church, and that's Casablanca. We know it from the movie, but I looked up, of course, on Wikipedia. There were at least 4 radio productions, adaptations.
There were.
After the 1942
including,
film.
Including, bizarrely, a half-hour version, which is
right.
a travesty. We're doing the 1944 Lux Radio Theater version.
Which did not feature Humphrey Bogart. It was Alan Ladd as
it
Rick?
Was Alan Ladd, Hedy Lamarr, and John Loder.
Hedy Lamarr
in the Ingrid
Bergman part.
Exactly. Lux was great because they had the biggest budget of their day. They frequently got the same actors who were in the movies to come sit in on the one-hour radio adaptions. In this particular case, they got none of them, so they completely replaced the cast.
With some big stars, though. It's
also some very big stars, but
it's
I mean,
not like they went slumming.
No, they didn't. But I mean, you don't get much bigger than Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman.
Oh, certainly
so.
Not. Certainly not at that time.
No,
you know, early 40s during the war.
Exactly. But we're gonna have a great time, and the most lovely part of what we get to do is not just to do the old stories and retell them and breathe new life into them, but we also get to redo all of the commercial breaks that occurred during that radio broadcast. And as it was sponsored by Lux Toilet Soap, audience members should expect to hear some very, very funny commercials in regards to it.
I was curious about one thing. Of course, it's very famous for the song "As Time Goes By." You know,
indeed.
"Play It, Sam." Humphrey Bogart says a Dooley Wilson in the role as the piano player Sam. Will you be recreating that too as part of the broadcast?
We will. Only in our particular case, we are reimagining Sam as a woman. So Sam will now be Samantha. And Samantha will be played by the very talented Linda Brown. She is a local actress and singer here in Portland. She'll get the opportunity to sing that classic song in its full, both before the show and in portion during the show.
And where can listeners find out more about the show tomorrow and get tickets if they like?
Everything is available on our website, so it's fakeradio.net. And if folks click on the shows link, they'll be able to see upcoming shows, including a link for tomorrow night. And we do still have some tickets available.
Oh, great. And I could tell everybody it's a real treat. I mean, it's, as David mentioned, it's kind of very true to old-time radio, but with a splash of humor, improv, ad-lib that brings it up to date, and everybody has a good time.
I like to call it a loving parody.
A loving parody.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll call it that. So, David Koff, again, thanks for joining us in the neighborhood this morning.
Thank you, Ken.
And that loving parody of Casablanca is tomorrow at the Old Church, at doors at 7 and curtain at 8.
Yes, sir. You've got it.
Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio. If you missed any part of the show, or would, in the immortal words of Humphrey Bogart, just like to play it again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KABU website. A big thank you to our guest today, David Shields, author of the new book, The Trouble with Men, Reflections on Sex, Love, Marriage, Porn, and Power. Portland writer Sally Tisdale, author of Advice for Future Corpses, A Practical Perspective on Death and Dying, and David Koff, of course, of Fake Radio, who along with Mindy Sterling and cast will be performing Casablanca, the radio theater version, live at the Old Church tomorrow, Saturday, March 30th, doors at 7, curtain at 8. Can't leave without giving a big thank you to our engineer, the inimitable, unparalleled, unimpeachable, and what a mensch, Sam Parrish. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying hope it's always a beautiful day in your neighborhood.
KABU Community Radio starts our spring membership drive starting April 8th, and before that, we'd love to hear from you directly about why you support KABU. My name is Mo, a KABU volunteer, and I support KABU because I grew up with KABU. It's part of my life, and I feel having a community outlet like KABU is so important because it creates a more vibrant community and a place where different ideas are not only heard, but honored. Why do you support KABU? Call us and let us know at 503-231-8032, extension 302, to leave a voicemail or tag us with your support on your social media posts. And thank you for supporting KABU.
KBOO is looking for a grant writer to join our team. We are seeking someone with a proven track record in writing successful, complex proposals for diverse sources of grant funding. Previous experience working in the philanthropic landscape of the Portland metro area is preferred, and previous experiences working with community media organizations and with communities of color are A+. This is a 1-year contract position for a total of 200 hours at $25 an hour, and the grant writer will work closely with the KBOO development director. For more information, go to our website at kboo.fm and click on the KBOO is hiring link on the right side of the home page.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM, Philomath and Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose. No good to nobody, no good for nothing. Because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down or songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I am out to fight those kind of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a part of your listening habits, your community, and your life. We are holding our spring membership drive.